You are listening to the Attention Please podcast on the Talking Stop Network. This is episode 9, being recorded on Wednesday, 26 September, India time. Today's episode is different indeed, and not just because we are recording a full 3 days behind our schedule, but because we have our first guest. And boy, did we hit this one out of the stands. But I'm not going to introduce our guest. That's a job much better left done by our host, Arnab. Welcome back, Arnab. How have you been?
Thank you. I've been good. And yes, this is the first episode of Attention Please podcast that we will have a guest. So normally any show whose anchor is Arnab, they normally things don't go well with the guest. The guest doesn't speak. But we're going to be different. Not all Arnabs are the same. So hopefully I will do a much better job of interacting with guests than Mr. Goswami does. And so my first guinea pig is going to be Prem Panikkar, who is a doyen of the Indian net world, who's really been, and I'm a huge fan of his. My own personal history, I first came on online in the late 90s. And really the only Indian person I used to read was Prem Panikkar. I mean, I was in the US then because, of course, it was in India, I couldn't get online. So I came to the US, this was 1999, and we had no way of, you know, checking out. There was, I think, Crick Info used to be there at that point of time. But nobody did match reports like Prem. Prem literally brought the game to life with his prose. Sometimes I forget nowadays, did I see the game or did I just read Prem talking about the game? And that's what happens with old memories. And sometimes I believe I think I saw it, but I possibly didn't see it. It was Prem describing it to me. And Prem was every time that Prem would write something, all the graduate students at Stony Brook, that was where I was doing my PhD, we would discuss, you know, Prem and, you know, whether Prem is biased against Saurav Ganguly. Since that's our single point agenda. So once Prem actually came to Stony Brook and I stood at the back, he was then with India Abroad, he was in New York. Remember, it was a very, very interesting session. We normally, nowadays in the days of think fests and these things happen all the time. But in those days, you never really got to see us, you know, a media celebrity in front of you. And this was definitely the first media celebrity I saw. So it was a great experience. So I really, really wanted him to be the first guest on my show. So thank you, Prem, for coming on Attention Please podcast.
Thank you so much, Arnab. It's interesting that you mentioned Stony Brook and the fact that we have a bit of a history, because I don't know if you remember, we started in 95, but around 98-ish, our live commentary had this thing where on the left side of the frame, I was doing ball by ball, and on the right, you had a comment section where people could comment, they could ask questions and stuff. And it got to a point where every time India was playing, I'd start my commentary and the first thing I know, all your fans at Stony Brook and elsewhere who were reading your blog would go, hey, have you read Arnab's latest? And, he's panned something that you've said or he's praised something that you've said. And half the time it seemed like we were having an extended conversation with some kind of third person. So, yeah, I remember that and it was huge fun. I also remember coming to Stony Brook and actually, funnily enough, that was the first time when I was in the US that I went to a university. After that, I think Stony Brook talked about it and then everybody sort of piled on. Uh-huh. It was huge fun because it was unscripted. It was freewheeling. It was challenging. One of the nice things about, you know, okay, young people kind of dates me, but one of the nice things about young people is irreverence. And that helps. You're constantly challenged to back up your opinions and stuff. So, yeah, thanks for the memories. And nice to be actually talking face-to-face. I mean, or at least directly without you know, filters of fans and stuff.
Yes, it's great to have you, Prem. So let's go into the questions. I really want to, again, I'm not a practiced anchorman. So apologies to our listeners. So I kind of created a kind of outline of the things that I really wanted to ask Prem. So the first thing I wanted to ask Prem is the India-England test series, what he thought of it, could we have done something different? And again, I don't think that we will be challenged in the West Indies series because they're coming to India. This is usually our pick me up after a bad foreign series so that we forget what happened. But let's not forget what happened in against England. So Prem, your take on the whole series and where we faltered and where we did pretty good.
Yeah, well, I mean, you probably know I haven't been writing about cricket for some time now. Lots of reasons, and if necessary, we can get into that later. But even following cricket, I've pretty much given up on following the one-dayers and the T20s, except when there is some kind of narrative or some kind of real interest beyond, you know, how many sixes are hit. Tests I've been following. I followed South Africa closely. I was following England a little bit disjointed because I was also traveling at the time, but I followed as much as I possibly could. And for me, the sad part was that before the series began, I remember I was having beer with a few friends. And again, I mean, we were talking about the upcoming series and what the prospects were. And my take was, look, if we get the team selection right, this is the best chance India has to replicate what the Wadika-led team did and to win a series in England. I really thought, A, that India had what it took, and B, that England were uniquely vulnerable. The sad part was the vulnerability showed up, but we just didn't capitalize. And I think a large part, I know the toss has been blamed and various other factors have been blamed, but I think if you were apportioning blame, for me, 75-80% of it was our own fairly shoddy way of going about it. I remember on the first morning when the team was picked, the only comment I made in public about the England series was as soon as the team news was announced at the toss on the first morning, I made a remark to the effect that I thought Kohli was a good T20 captain, a fairly okay one-day captain, and a lousy test captain, and I got slammed for it. Getting slammed is not particularly new, but yeah. And the fun part is this is how internet discussions happen, right? I mean, Kohli scores some runs and everybody is like, Prem, are you watching? Yes, I was watching. The point is not one guy scoring runs, right? But yeah, that's how it worked out. I thought we missed a golden chance, and we don't have anyone else to blame for it. That's broadly my take.
So do you think, and this is a fairly unpopular opinion, but I think I aired this in a episode prior to this, is most of the narratives that I read was that Indian bowling was amazing. It's the batting which let us down, which is okay, but I also think that the bowling let us down because the reason why we were going in with five bowlers, that's what I've heard, is that apparently if you go in with four bowlers, then the opposition, they just become tired by the time the number six and the number seven batsmen come into bat. And so we've always had this problem that we have not been able to get the tail out. And the reason that one of the reasons that it has always been put forward was because we play with four bowlers and they just get tired by that time. This time we had five bowlers, and yet we couldn't get the tail out. I mean, that was really the problem. We got the top order out pretty much every time, except the last test. Do you agree, or do you think now the bowler still did good? It was the batsman who sucked.
No, I heard that podcast of yours, Arnab, and I actually agree. It's not, I think, talking in a binary, the bowlers let us down, the batsmen let us down. This is basically a problem, right? If you remember, we used to have this program called Match Ka. And all that. And our way of looking at a match is find somebody to blame. That also coincidentally happens to be our way of looking at politics and pretty much everything else. The bowlers let us down in two ways. One, it's not just the bowlers. It's not arithmetical. It's not like you say five bowlers, therefore the bowlers won't be tired by the time the tail comes along. In the first place, Arnab, if the tail is exposed by the 40th over, why the hell are the bowlers tired? That's one of the things I didn't get. The other part of it is it's not five bowlers. It is who the five bowlers are, right? Every single time we pick the wrong bowler for the wrong course. When we have a potentially dry track, we pick four seamers, including Hardik Pandya, who had nothing to do in that first test, and one spinner. And it turns out that the ball is turning square almost. When we have a overcast conditions, a wet pitch, seaming conditions, we pick two spinners. And then we dump one of the spinners because he wasn't effective. Obviously, he wasn't. That was a grassy pitch. We pick Ashwin when he was clearly unfit. So that is one part of it. The other part of it is also, I don't know. I mean, I think this is an endemic problem. You've been following cricket like forever. Have you noticed that every time you have two good batsmen at the crease, this new team is attacking. It has intent and all those buzzwords. And then the minute the main batsmen are out and the lower middle order and tail start coming in, we seem to slip into this thing of we'll give this guy one single and let the other guy we'll try and attack the other guy. I don't get it. If you can attack two top batsmen, why can't you attack a lower middle order batsman the same way? Curran comes in and the field spreads. And the guy just takes advantage. He slogs when he can, and then he takes a single off the last ball and stitches up these partnerships. And we do it every single time, which I put down to captaincy. I put down to really bad thinking. These guys could have been attacked, but weren't. Another way bowlers take wickets is through catches, and we keep shuffling our slips around. We don't seem to know who our slip fielders are. So it's a bit of pretty much everything, but to your broad point that, yeah, it's not just the batting that let us down, it's also the bowling. Yes, they did. They also had this thing of when the tailenders come in, you get aggro, you start pitching short. Look, you get six batsmen, competent batsmen playing in home conditions, you get them out with the good length, the ball that seems away late. And the minute a tailender comes, you think that you have to pitch it on your own bootlaces. I'm sure there's some thinking in the dressing room, hopefully, but that's surely not what they were told to do. And they did it over and over again. So, yeah.
So for me, I think, and again, I might be alone in this, but I think there's a fundamentally different way in which you bowl to tailenders than when you bowl to top class batsmen. The assumptions are not the same. There's this the Don Bradman in his autobiography, which for those of you who haven't read, I strongly recommend you read it. It's one of the best books on cricket I've ever read. And I used to read a lot of them at one point of time. So there was in those days the pitches used to be not covered. So what Bradman did was in those sticky wickets it rained, and so Bradman inverted the batting order. So he sent out Fleetwood Smith, I think,
yeah,
and O'Reilly. He sent them out. And he came in and there was like about an hour or so to go. And they were shocked that they were being asked to pad up and bat in these conditions. And so his logic was, look, on a good pitch, there's no, you can't touch the ball. On this pitch, you have absolutely no chance. And as long as you don't touch the ball, you guys are okay. And so they batted out that whole day. And then Bradman said O'Reilly was out to the first ball he touched the next day. And by that time, the water had dried and Bradman came like seven down or something and scored a double century or something. So they kind of totally inverted the order and they made 600, some ridiculous thing. But it was, I think it brings out the point that I think also the England bowlers at that point of time, and I'm speculating, were bowling to O'Reilly and these guys like they would bowl to a normal opener. They were bowling to him on the corridor. They were trying to get the outswing and they were not biting because it's just beyond them to play like that. So one of the problems is I think India bowls in exactly the same way to the tail ender that they were bowling to the guys who came before them. This also hampered by the fact that we've, and this is not just with this team, but we have historically not had very good Yorker bowlers like Wasim, you know, or Malinga. So against lower quality batsmen, that's virtually unplayable, that kind of delivery, or really, really, really good mystery spinners, like people who can really turn the ball, like a Rashid Khan. So against tailenders, you need those kind of bowlers to basically take the tail out. And I've been watching, as you said, Prem, I've been watching Test cricket from God knows when. I remember in the Calcutta Test, this was when West Indies were at their peak. This was 1983. Gavas, this was the fifth test. This was the fifth test, the one before Chennai. Yes.
Yeah.
So one the way for Chennai, this is the test which Gavaskar got out first ball. We made, you know, Kapil Dev, he had a rear guard action. We made like 250 or something. And then West Indies came out to bat. And this is the best, the pretty much one of the greatest teams that ever played test cricket. And India had all of them out, like Greenidge, Haynes, Gomes and Richards. Getting Richards out. And they were out with, I don't remember, 50 runs or something. They were, all four of them were out.
Correct.
And then Lloyd, I think Juduja also got out. Juduja was a good, this Malcolm Marshall. And then they couldn't get Andy Roberts out. They couldn't get Michael Holding out. And they just kept on batting. They made like 58 runs. One of them made. They just blocked. Shivlal Yadav hit six. And of course, Shivlal Yadav just can't, he's not that kind of guy who can bamboozle a Michael Holding. I remember because those were days when I used to like watch every ball. And so I remember these are like seared into my memory. I think India has had this persistent problem throughout their history. And I think we saw it this time too, that we just don't have that kind of it bowler. That is, I think Anderson is in many ways, because Anderson is freakishly good with his outswingers. And he can bowl to the, he can bowl to the tail enders. I think that was another reason. But what specific, so in terms of the teams playing that were selected, who would you have selected differently as a batsman? Do you think the batting was pretty much the best we had?
Well, let's step back a little bit and instead of talking of the names, let's talk about what a team needs, right, from the batting order. You need settled openers, one. That's so obvious that it almost goes without saying. You need your number three to know what his role is. One of the reasons why Dravid made such a good number three was that nobody expected him to bat with intent or, you know, score at a Virat Kohli pace or whatever. His job was, if a wicket falls early, you ensure that the fast bowlers don't break through at one end. And then you hold your end, you keep the board ticking over and let the others bat around you. It was very clear to not just Dravid, but to the team. And nobody expected anything else from him. You need your number four to be the one that starts turning the game around, taking the attack. And we have the ideal number four. We have Virat Kohli coming in at that position. But if you look at the top three, and if you look at how we select our teams, look, you can say horses for courses and all those cliches that we normally use. But here's the thing. If you pick 38 different teams for 38 different test matches in sequence, I think there's something seriously wrong. It's not horses for courses so much as it's just complete confusion. I don't see the logic behind it. And what that tells me is that as a batsman in the top 5-6, I'm never sure of what my position is. I'm not sure if I'm going to play the next match. I'm not sure if something is expected of me or what is expected of me. Here's a classic example, right? I remember Akash Chopra opening with Virendra Sehwag in Australia. And it was very clear what Akash was supposed to do. Virendra Sehwag is like, yeah, he'll either score 100 before lunch or he might get out of the second ball trying to clear the fence. And Akash was supposed to hold one end up. That was probably the first time that we had a series of consistently good partnerships in Australia. Akash would just turn the strike over to Viru and Viru would do his thing. More often than not, it worked. But the same Akash then went, I mean, he pretty much embedded himself in the team. But then when he went to Pakistan, the whole thing changed. The team expected him to bat differently. And from whatever I heard at the time, I think there was some confusion about the roles. Akash thought that he was supposed to bat the way he was batting already. And the team expected something else. And next thing you know, Akash is out and Shikhar Dhawan is in because Shikhar will, you know, hit the ball around early on. The point I'm trying to make is, did we pick the best team? For me, it's two things. One, personnel, pick the right person, embed that person, give them an extended run. We talk about all this in press conferences and stuff like that, about keeping the faith with the players and stuff. How are we keeping the faith if we're changing the team every single test match? I mean, how do the two things compute? And the corollary to that is, put yourself in the mind of a batsman and you've done what is expected of you, or probably you failed even. But you don't know on the morning of the next test match whether you're going to play or not. If you play, at what position you're going to be playing in, what the team expects of you. You do one thing and the team expects another thing. It's happened with Pujara, right? I mean, there have been games when Pujara plays Pujara. And that happens to be a batting track, but Pujara still goes on at his 50, 60 strike rate. He rarely accelerates beyond that. Right. And then you have commentators and experts and even whispers from within the team saying, oh, you know, Pujara is holding up everybody else. So my question is, do the players in the team even know where they belong? Do they belong and what is expected of them anymore? If they don't, then you have a fundamental problem over there, and then swapping one person out for another person is just cosmetic.
I agree with that. I feel that Pujara should have played in the first test, because Pujara had been playing in England for a while, and even though he hadn't been a rocking success, at least he had been playing in England for some time. You got to give him that. And for them to not have him in the first test, and he's the guy, as we all, he's the closest to Dravid in that respect. I'm not saying his greatness is at that level. He hasn't shown it. I hoped he would, but I don't think he has.
No, he hasn't.
Not at Rahul Dravid's level, by definitely. But he's the best we have in terms of that number three role. And this is even more important because of the guy who comes in number five, who for me was the biggest disappointment, was Ajinkya Rahane. And it was disappointing for one reason and one reason. Because when Ajinkya Rahane came on the scene, it seemed like he would be the counterfoil to Kohli. So Kohli can be, you know, attacking, he can play effectively in his one-day mode. And you would have Rahane, who was technically very solid. And he was technically very solid. But this time, when I saw the way he was getting out, every time he was not showing the full face of the bat. And sometimes it seems like very pat to say, I saw this in IPL. But I'm going to say that I've seen him do this in IPL, because in IPL, he's under pressure to score. And his get-out shot, his basically pressure release shot, because he can't hit the heavy shots like a Gale. So he can't do that. So one of his most effective shots is the shot that he plays over square leg and over third man, where he just changes the orientation of the bat and it flies off. And he was trying to do that over here. His body was getting into that position. And there was at least one time, I remember, at least twice he played on almost, because his body was kind of unbalanced. I think he was getting into his T20 mode, and then he was realizing, no, I'm not in T20. And that's all the time that you need in order to make a mistake. And I'm really worried about him. I'm less worried about everybody else, because if he isn't there, I just don't see anybody at that spot. I just don't see anybody there at that spot. Do you have any idea who could be Rohit Sharma?
No. No. Let's not go there. Rohit Sharma reminds me of Yuvraj Singh. You remember Yuvraj Singh in Test matches? 10 years after he made his debut. I mean, seriously, man. 10 years after he made his debut, we were still talking about his promise. You know, even checks after 3 months, if you don't cash them, you can't have a promising player 10 years after he's made his debut. And I think guys like Rohit, Shikhar abroad in challenging conditions and stuff like that, it's time we sort of gave it up. Like the Indian government is writing off all the bad debts and stuff. We need to think beyond that. One intriguing, again, I just wanted to talk laterally to what you were saying, Arnab. You were talking about Ajinkya and that conversation that I was telling you about on the eve of the test series. Mm-hmm. The one statement I made that has come back at me in many, many ways at many times, because my friends don't let me forget anything I've ever said. I did say that the two hinges of India's performance, one would be whether Kohli can shake off the nightmare of the previous test, and two, whether Rahane is embedded at five and nobody disturbs him. And yeah, like you, I'm fairly shocked at the way he played. He is far too technically good to keep making that mistake over and over again. Once, twice, yes, but right through the test match, it was almost as if he was trying to, yeah, like you said, he was trying to score more rapidly than the conditions permitted. And there was nothing in the game situation that required rapid scoring at any of those points where he played those silly open the bat shots. Somebody needs to sit that boy down and tell him what his role in the side is, and tell him that he really has to either shape up or he could be shipped out. About replacements, I don't know. I mean, I keep hearing all these names, some of them from the U19 kids who are coming up. That's the other thing that I don't like about the Indian team. We seem to think that roles are interchangeable, that there is no such thing as a mindset for a particular position. Yeah, you, in an emergency, have to bat anyway. You can't just say that I'll only bat at four or not at all. But that said, look at the way we... Rahul at number three, I mean, come on, he's an opener. You either play him, he deserves a place as an opener, or he doesn't. Because you want to fit Rahul into the side, you keep Pujara out of the side. Then Rahul doesn't work at number three, you bring Pujara back in, and Pujara doesn't know whether he's supposed to be Cheteshwar or supposed to be KL Rahul. The same way, I'm wondering, among the players I've seen, I like Prithvi. I think he has the adaptability and the game. I still don't get why Manish Pandey is not more in the frame than he already is. But outside of that, for me, it's still Rahane is the first pick if he can get his head together. And I think you made the point earlier. One of the sad things that's going to happen is West Indies will come here and, you know, we'll probably play most of the known names. And you won't use that chance to actually see if some of these options work. So when we're talking about options, we're making the same mistake, right? I mean, we see Manish Pandey in domestic cricket or T20 cricket or something and say, hey, why is this guy not playing in test matches? It's not that simple. My point is, games where we can afford to take the chance, we should be blooding these guys and seeing what they're capable of. We should be playing Prithvi in the side and seeing if we can make it. We should be playing Manish. And we should be giving ourselves options, which we don't. I remember Lakshman once complaining about this. He said, look, every time we go abroad, I'm expected to play the main role. Everybody says, oh, you know, Lakshman is going to be the key. And then when it comes to an India series, I get dropped and other batsmen, you know, fill their boots up with runs.
Right.
It was one of those rare moments when you heard Lakshman actually feel, you know, a bit aggrieved about the way he had been treated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's happening all over again. I mean, Indian cricket is pretty much, you know, that old thing about it repeats itself first as tragedy and then as farce. Yeah.
So I'm going to be interested in what happens to Hanuma Vihari. So what is the plan for Hanuma Vihari? First of all, I saw that he had a good series, but then he was suddenly dropped into the test side and he batted. Is he going to be persisted with in West Indies, or that's it? That's the last we have heard of Hanuma Vihari. Because we've had, again, as history repeats itself, we've had so many cases of, you know, people suddenly coming in a dead rubber when everything's lost, not making a great, like, impact, but not playing badly either, perhaps for one test, and then not being selected. And one thing that Prem, I don't know if you, I know you don't follow T20 or IPL that much, but I feel that right now there is an inordinate amount of mind space that those who play in, who do well in IPL command. And I love IPL in many ways. I don't think IPL is the source of all evil. But unless a lot of people, I believe, in the last few years have played cricket, test cricket or one day cricket much faster than they should have because of IPL. And vice versa, I think one of the reasons why Pujara always struggles, he's always like, whenever the series starts, it's always like, Pujara is struggling, like, because people don't see a lot of him. They don't see him in IPL because he obviously can't play IPL. That's been proven. He's tried. I think he suffers from that. I think a lot of these players, I think definitely Shikhar Dhawan has the other advantage. People remember him from his one days and his, you know, superlative performances in IPL. And he automatically is the number one choice for test matches. It's almost a psychological trick. It's almost like a card trick, I believe. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Again, I mean, I'm totally in agreement. The fun part here is, you know, when IPL was launched, I remember Lalit Modi in an interview saying that this is going to be the nursery of Indian cricket. It's going to be the feeder into the, you know, one day team and the test team and all that. And that was one of the few things that Lalit Modi said that I actually agreed with, that by broadening the base and also giving, you know, the young players, John Wright, way back once we were having a conversation and he was talking about how difficult it was to coach. And one of the points he made that stuck with me was, he said, look, I'm getting these guys at 22 and 23 and 24 and stuff like that, and they've already learned their bad habits. I need them to have at least had a good grounding before they actually step into the national team so that you can then elevate their fitness, their performance, all of that. IPL was supposed to do that because, I mean, you have all these foreign coaches coming in. You get to play against and with the best of the foreign players. You learn a lot. We're already seeing signs of that.
Yes, we've seen that. That's a good thing.
Yeah, and I'm not exactly anti IPL. It's just that, you know, for 2 months to do nothing but watch pretty much the same teams playing against the same teams over and over again gets a bit boring. It lacks the narrative that I keep looking for in sport. But that said, if IPL is supposed to be a feeder system, then I don't have a problem with IPL players being in the frame. The thing is, the thing that I keep going back to is, are you blooding them into the team the right way? Are you picking for the right reasons? Are you giving them an opportunity to sort of first be with the team, be giving them a sense of what the team's expectations of them are? All of this goes back to what I think the fundamental problem with the Indian team is that it has a dressing room that is almost inevitably not a good sort of nursery for talent. We get lucky. We don't, whatever we accomplish is not because of planning, but because of sheer dumb luck.
I agree, yes.
Yeah, and so your point about Vihari, right? I mean, do we remember Karun Nair?
Yeah, 300 runs.
Yeah, 300 runs, and the next match he's out. What is that guy supposed to do? We keep talking about how he's messed up. I mean, I don't see how he wouldn't be messed up. He must have probably spent all his match fees on psychiatric treatment. If 300 is not good enough when everybody else is failing, then, you know, what am I expected to do? So somewhere along the way, these are the things that bother me, that we are finding talent. And if you look at the Indian team, a lot of them are IPL, alumni. But we're not really giving them hothouse conditions to flourish in.
Okay, so let's move on. I think this was very interesting. I could keep on talking about this, but let's move on to another topic because there's so much left. So you said that you don't write on cricket anymore. Tell us a little bit about that. Why don't you write on cricket anymore?
Well, I think it is a combination of things. I think if you remember the 90s, we launched in December 95 and in February 96 was the World Cup. And one of the things that Rediff struggled with was we couldn't get anybody to join us. Everybody said, what is this thing? Nobody had seen the internet, right? I mean, in 96, how many connections did you have in India?
Yeah, nobody knew what it was.
Yeah, so I remember some of the stars who we approached all saying, oh, we are mainstream journalists. And what are you guys doing sitting in a garage and stuff like that? So I got roped into cricket writing by default, literally, because... I mean, I distinctly remember a week before the World Cup, our CEO looking around, have we found somebody to cover the World Cup? No. And then he looks around and pretty much everybody is overweight and unfit and you know, had no connection with sport whatsoever. And he said, Prem, I seem to remember you saying that you played cricket in school and college. Okay, you're covering the World Cup. That's it. That was my job interview for being a cricket correspondent. So I had to pretty much invent this for myself and that first year was fun because we kept trying things. I was told on day one that a cricket report had to be contained within one scroll. You remember that time? The internet was supposed to be one scroll. You can't go below that. Yeah. And I was like, how the hell am I supposed to? Yeah, how am I supposed to cover a match in one scroll? I'm not going to do that. So basically, I had, I said the hell with rules and yeah, you were very kind to say that it felt like you were watching the match. That's what I was trying to do. But Arnab, the problem was that India played so damn much that those were the days when, you know, if we had a spare weekend, we called Sri Lanka or we went over to Sri Lanka. And beyond a point, it's like if you're covering matches ball by ball, besides that, you have to do a match report at the end of it. You have to do the analysis columns, and then you had to write around cricket. I think after a bit, it became too much. Mm-hmm. Just before I joined Rediff, I was working with Krishna Prasad in Sunday Observer, and we had already done one story on not match fixing so much as on bookies.
Okay.
And how they operate, and we had a glimpse of what was going on in that world. So there was a certain cynicism coming in already, and then, you know, the whole match fixing thing exploded. And at some point, I got to this point of thinking, look, I'm looking at something, and I'm saying this is why India chose to bat first or bowl first, or I'm looking at the way a particular batsman got out or a field was set, and I'm trying to analyze it, and then it turns out that it's not because of any of the factors that I thought. It's because, you know, somebody was making money off of it. And the combination of the fatigue involved, you know, I have actually covered that India game against Sri Lanka, where Sri Lanka scored some 900 and whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, the one that Jayasuriya scored.
And I covered it. Yeah, and I covered it ball by ball. So for 2 days, all I was doing was Kumble to Jayasuriya, four through the covers. I mean, seriously. At that point, two things happened, and frankly, I should give you some of the credit or discredit for this as well. I think it was you or somebody on your blog who once did a parody of a Prem Panicker match report.
No, not me.
Yeah, okay. So, and I wasn't blaming you for it. It really was an epiphany, because I realized that what I was doing was, you know, because you can't come up with new narratives if you're doing a match report every other day. I was falling into this templated way of writing. You know, who won the toss? Why did they choose to bat first or bowl first? Whatever the teams, da-da-da, first innings, this is what happened. Second innings, this is what happened. And I just wanted out there. I realized that it was stifling me as a writer. I was doing the same thing over and over again. It all kind of came together. And part of the reason also was that I was never just a pure cricket writer, right? I mean, I was one of the founding team of Rediff. So I had a lot of responsibilities other than that. So then if you're doing 10 hours of cricket and then another 8 hours of, you know, administrative work and stuff related to the other departments and things, it just got too much.
Yes.
So I think it was a combination. And I think this lot, one of the things I loved about the team that I covered most often, the Sourav Ganguly, Rahul Dravid, Sachin Tendulkar, that lot, mm-hmm. was that you could be critical. And sometimes you got it right, sometimes you got it wrong, it didn't matter. These guys took the criticism, sometimes they argued. I've had calls in the middle of the night from Sourav. Actually, one of the funny things that happened once, I was in an airport and Sourav was behind me, he tapped me on the shoulder. Mm-hmm. I turned around, I say hello, and the first thing he says is, "What, you're not writing about me anymore these days?" And I was like, "Why did you say that?" So he says, no, every time you write, you know, all the Bengalis abuse you, and then I have a lot of fun reading the abuses. So yeah, I mean, those guys were, they accepted you at face value. They accepted the fact that if you were critical, it was not because you were personally attacking them. This lot is arrogant. They, in the first place, they are so hedged around with you know, brand consultants and what you can say and what you can do that they've become colorless. Mm-hmm. And B, they have a sort of arrogance that goes with this. You know, don't question me. Look at Virat's reactions to the most basic question there. Come on. Every captain we've known, Sourav, Rahul, Anil.
Dhoni is very aggressive if he doesn't like a question. Yeah.
Exactly. So it started, I'm not saying that Virat is the sole culprit. It started with Dhoni's time. But all the captains that we've known before, and pretty much all the superstars have been captains at one point or the other, they have faced very hard questions in press conferences without losing their cool. This lot, it's like even the mildest sort of question, do you think you guys have done, played up to your potential? And they start off, this is the best team that's ever been, or this is the best team of the last 20 years. So, come on. So yeah, all these put together, I just sort of gave up.
Right. I totally understand what you mean. And one thing that has changed, I guess.
Arnab, one other thing.
Yes.
One reason for giving up, and that's also a prime reason, is, look, back when I started writing, you guys went watching the game.
I was going to say that, watching the part of it, yeah. Yes.
So I had a role to play. I could show you what you couldn't see.
Yes.
Today, everybody is watching. What am I going to do? Look at match reports. They're just scoreboards and pros.
Yes. You were a Sanjay, for those of us who couldn't see. Literally, you were a Sanjay. We saw it through you. And I was going to say exactly that thing, that nowadays, everybody watches every game on Hotstar or Willow in the US. So you're right. There's really no need to write like that anymore. And that's why also I don't read. Honestly, I absolutely agree with you. When I read cricket writing nowadays, I mean, some people write very well, of course. I mean, there's some great, great writing in cricket, still happens. Not too often, but still happens. And you're right. The match reports are absolutely scorecards. There's nothing in them beyond what you saw. There is no analysis. And I think this is symptomatic of not just cricket, but pretty much politics and everything else. Movies also, is that it's all about access journalism nowadays. And nobody wants to piss off the big guys, whether it be in movies, whether it be in politics, whether it be in sports. And there's just so much money in it that I understand why they just don't want to piss off people, because it's just so easy to say, no, I'm not going to give you access. So I understand why, you know, cricket writing has kind of become flaccid. I also believe that, at least if you go back and read, you know, even Cricinfo's older articles, they were much more, whether you liked it or not, they were much more opinionated. And nowadays, people don't write opinions any longer because they're afraid of being trolled. I don't know what it is, but people just nowadays, at least I've seen this, and this is limited only to cricket, by the way. In news, the trend is totally different because they really want to be trolled. In cricket, I find that most of the writing is fairly anodyne. I mean, nobody really expresses an opinion anymore. It's like IPL commentary. It's like the commentators there are told not to express any opinion on anything.
Yeah, so what you're having these days is, you know, commentary or match reports for the presumption is that you're both deaf and blind. I mean, seriously, look at what happens in commentary, right? You have people who have played, who can actually add nuance to what they're saying. And what do? The ball is outside the off stump. Virat Kohli takes that long stride. He has that knack of playing a cover drive where he sort of seems to hold the ball on his bat for just that second and then guide it where he wants. And immediately you have the voice of the commentator saying, that's a beautiful cover drive through the gap all the way for four runs. I mean, what did I just see? And what did you tell me? And the other thing that you notice, the commentator will be in full flight. He'll be in the middle of a sentence and suddenly the scoreboard will flash up on the screen and he'll say, India is now. So, I mean, the presumption is I am blind. I can't see what's going on. And that's spread to match reports. And I agree. I was thinking of the golden age of cricket writing when you had, you know, people like Amit Verma. Sharda was fresh and Sharda is still one of the flag bearers of really good writing. But you had Amit, you had Chandrahas Chaudhary, you had Rahul Bhattacharya, you had Rahul Bhatia, you had Siddharth Vaidyanathan, all of them together under the Cricinfo umbrella. And so every day, even if they were talking about the same players and the same sort of, you know, India, Sri Lanka or whatever, the voices were different. Today, all the voices are flattened out and there is a much of a muchness to it and it's really become boring. I mean, you're not the only one who stopped reading. I haven't in a long, long time read, you know, anything other than stories of cricket. Cricket match reports, I just give up on.
And there's another thing, at least this is not so much in cricket writing, but in cricket coverage, especially for one day and IPL, is that there is now, they have to be like circus announcers. So they're not just commentators, they're circus announcers. At every 5 seconds, they need to say that this is unprecedented. The crowd is going wild. You know, nobody has ever seen batting like this before. And you say this every
atmosphere,
game.
Atmosphere. Don't forget atmosphere.
The atmosphere. And there might be terrific atmosphere. There might be like, I mean, there might be 10,000 people in a 40,000. But they'll just show that and they'll have these guys and the cameraman. And I've been at games and the cameraman comes and says, you know, do the Mexican wave. That's when they will show it. And so much of commentary is taken up by that kind of circus announcing. That's it. It's about 50% of the time is advertising for the game while the game is going on.
Yeah, that's the thing that IPL did, right? I mean, one of the negatives of the IPL was it put cheerleaders on the field and it also put cheerleaders in the commentary box. Yes. And So moving on,
Prem, as you know, kind of, you know, I always associated you with Rediff, and you know, Rediff was really the only place to go. And again, it was kind of expected that it would change, but Rediff was like Yahoo in terms of the Indian internet media space, and Rediff kind of lost that leadership position. So, do you have any hypothesis? Do you have any insight into, you know, why that happened? Or do you think it was in any case going to be inevitable with so many players coming into the field?
I don't think inevitable is the right word, Arnab. I think there is a certain tendency in corporates, and I'm not talking just of media now, but basically corporates, to become very agile and nimble when they're starting out and then become very sclerotic, very risk averse as they grow. I saw that happen in Rediff. You know that commentary thing that we did? Mm-hmm. I remember how it started. There was, just like the Stony Brook kids used to write to us, mm-hmm. There was this group from Harvard that after the first 5 or 6 match reports, I think, of the 96 World Cup, they wrote saying, look, we love the match reports, but given the time difference, we have to wait till next morning to figure out what is going on and stuff. And is it possible to do a halftime match report so we can see that and then go to sleep? Mm-hmm. Ajit Balakrishnan asked me if it was possible. I said, yeah, sure, there's half an hour between innings. So, yeah, I can do that. And we started putting that up. And then, after another 4 or 5 games, we had this the same group writing in and saying, look, every hour, can you just write one paragraph and put it up? So at that point in time, we were working on we had just one table, one round table, and we were all working around that. It was fairly chaotic. And in sheer exasperation, I said, at this rate, these guys are going to ask for an update every 2 minutes. So there was this one tech guy we had who was sitting there minding his own business. And I think he caught this out of the corner of his ear. And he suddenly said, then I can make a box for you where you can type something in and click send and off it'll go. Now, I had no idea what doing ball by ball was going to entail physically or mentally. I just said, okay, let's try it. And we did. And next day we launched live ball by ball commentary. It was that simple, right? Yeah. Now, the same Rediff, we grew. We did the IPO, we could hire more staff, we had departments, and then suddenly everything comes to a standstill. Any idea you have to make a PowerPoint presentation, you have to talk about the gives and gets, you have to talk ROI, you have to do all kinds of nonsense, and then finally one group or the other will say, this doesn't seem like it's worth doing right now, maybe we'll revisit it after 6 months or whatever. Look, Rediff, before there was Facebook, before there was any of these things, we started something called Connections, which had the exact same idea as LinkedIn, bring people together on interest groups. We were the first to, for instance, give you unlimited email space. We forced others to do it by being the first in the field. At that time, we just did what we thought was right. And then we got into this sort of paralysis, where everything was a meeting and a conference, and then the meeting would end with setting up another meeting. And it's not just Rediff. You know, the funny thing happened in Yahoo. They once brought in a new CMS. Mm-hmm. And the first day we were working on the CMS, it so happened that I was editing a story which had a couple of very good images, and I needed to write captions that were not descriptive, but around the image. And I kept writing, and I suddenly realized none of it was registering. You wrote a 20-word caption, and 7 characters, 7 words showed up. And it happened repeatedly. I thought it was a bug. I tried to fix it, couldn't. So I got in touch with the Yahoo Tech head office at Sunnyvale. And guess what? I get a mail back saying, please explain with examples why you need more characters in your caption. This was sent by Tech. They wanted to know why I need to write a long caption. And I had to actually do examples. That's what happens, right? I mean, we get sclerotic as organizations. We don't, and see, one of the things earlier was in print and in television, the pace of technology is very, very slow. There's been no advancement in television technology in the last, I don't know how long, maybe DTH, maybe the fact that you can now stream a lot of television channels, but all that has happened because of the internet. But on the internet, the problem is that the pace of development is so rapid that you either are thinking ahead of the game or you're left behind badly. And companies like Rediff and Yahoo, I think, got into the sort of trouble they have and lost the early mover advantage simply because they just didn't think fast enough.
That's, I think, yeah. I mean, there's an excellent article written somewhere where this guy who was in Yahoo kind of deconstructs the failure of Yahoo. It was fascinating. And his basic contention was that Yahoo never thought of itself as a technology, as a tech company. That it was not a tech company, it was a media company, and its main value proposition was they were going to sell advertisements cheaper than magazines. And this worked for a while because it was true that ads were cheaper in Yahoo than they were in magazines, but then nobody started reading magazines. And Yahoo never really had the tech. They didn't want to build things. They were happy as long as they were selling advertisements, and they were selling a whole lot of them. And all the tech people basically went to Google because they were not valued there, because it was being led by the managers, the guys with the MBAs, the guys whose main thing was, let's make money versus let's just build the cool things first. And we'll think about money later, which was really how Google started out. So that was what led to that. And, you know, I mean, Rediff, also another thing that Rediff had, again, whether it was a good or bad thing, I don't know, but the famous Rediff comment space, which was really Twitter before Twitter, where it's essentially the Twitter kind of conversations used to take place there, if you remember, Prem. And it was great joy for me, not just to read the articles, but to go and read the comments. Especially the North versus South dust-ups there. I don't know if you recall that.
Oh, yeah, and Prem Panicker versus Bengalis.
yes, of course. And so this is a nice segue. You know, do you think that the net world has changed? We often say that, you know, discourse has become more uncivil. But do you think it was always there? It's just that there are more people, so we hear it more?
I think so, yes, because just as you said, you know, Rediff had those comments and they used to be very vibrant. You know, those comment sections have actually helped me discover writers. There used to be this lady called Sujata Prakash, if you remember, wrote on Rediff.
Uh-huh, yes.
Wrote very good articles. There was a Daniel Laidlaw who wrote from Australia with an Australian perspective. Neither of them were journalists. There were people who would pop up in comments and say interesting things, and then I could reach out to them and say, hey, listen, why don't you write a piece on this? And we actually found new, fresh voices through our comment section. But I think beyond a point in time, what used to happen was the anonymity factor kicked in. You realized that you could just create multiple accounts and troll and stuff like that. So much as people say that Twitter and to an extent Facebook has been responsible for this deterioration, I think it happened a long time before. I shut down the common side of the commentary panel way back in about, I think, 2001 or so, simply because, I mean, it got way too much. I don't know what the pleasure is that people take in that, but every time there is a good conversation, there seems to be this need to disrupt it. And yeah, it's one of the unfortunate side effects of anybody has a voice on the internet. I agree that people should have a voice. I wish they would use it more responsibly is the most polite way I can put this, I think.
I agree. And again, I mean, I think the television media and some of the websites, some of the net media organizations, I believe are responsible for a lot of the polarization that's happening today. But for those of us who have lived through Rediff comment space, we basically saw it. I remember, I mean, one of my favorite things is to say, when you have, you know, basically people for duking out on Twitter, is this is beginning to resemble Rediff Common Space, because and one thing that I really miss, and as we're winding down, I want to remind all you of the listeners who were old hands at Rediff, this picture with a celebrity section.
Oh, yeah.
Which used to be my absolute favorite for the comments. I would obsessively go there to check if people had given new comments on that picture, because that I do not think there's anything on the net which is even remotely close to that picture with celebrity on Rediff, and I still miss that a lot. So
yeah, and again, I mean, if you're talking innovation, that is one of the things. It was completely accidental. Somebody sent a picture with one of the cricket celebs. And we were like, hey, this sounds like a plan. And we asked for it. And we got flooded. And of course, the comments then kicked in and it became a whole lot of fun of an entirely different kind. I like the way you are, you pause and phrase these things very politely, because, yeah, because, I mean, if we were having an off-record conversation, that's certainly not what you would have said in
It wouldn't be. First of all, you know, one of the things is, and Vikram will back me up on this, but there's something called an adult filter in iTunes. So this right. This podcast is not characterized as adult, so I can't swear. For some strange reason, Apple has this, you know, Doordarshan way of imposing censorship in this day and age. I don't know what their problem is.
That's only for India, though. And feel free to drop the F-bomb. We can beep you out. That's no problem. No,
but the fact is, it kind of, like, when you can't say that, it kind of civilizes the whole conversation. And you cannot have that, like, back and forth where you slip that in, because you always will. I don't want iTunes to take this down. If we talk, we can have this conversation someday again. With more colorful language. But Prem, moving on as we wind down, what about your future? I mean, what are your current projects? What are you planning to do? Because I got a lot of comments when I asked for questions. It's, people are basically asking you, where are you and what are you doing nowadays?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a... So when I quit Yahoo, one of the things that occurred to me was that, you know... at that time, I was 27 years in this profession, and it occurred to me that I had never taken a holiday, literally. The few times when I was off work was because I was ill or one of those things. The longest holiday I had, holiday being used loosely, was when my dad died. And I went down for the 14-day ceremony, stayed over for a couple of days and stuff like that. So I just wanted, I thought I was on this whole, treadmill where... I was running because the treadmill was on and I wanted to step off. My wife and I discussed this and she said, look, as long as we can continue to pay the bills, I really don't care. Why don't you take time off? And that's what I did. I took about a couple of years. All I was doing was reading and kind of catching up with myself. You know how when you're working full time, even your reading becomes part of work, right? I mean, you're reading for work.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I wanted to see what else was out there. I read a lot. I read widely. I wrote, but not too much. I wrote when I wanted to. So there were games where I thought there was something that I could say. I love doing, for instance, other sport. I wrote a bit on football. I wrote a bit on badminton. It allowed me to see if my voice had become straitjacketed, and realizing that it hadn't, kind of gave me a bit of a boost. This year, I wanted to do. So I started that thing called Peeply, which was in-depth reporting on various issues. Mm-hmm. It was basically funded by the four of us who started it, and I thought then, and I still think, that there is a need for that in these days where, you know, coverage of anything, issues, is basically a mile wide and a millimeter deep. Mm-hmm. That was what my plan was for this year. But then the whole Paul Salopek thing happened. We started doing, initially it was the walk once he entered India. Okay. But there were also this condition of Paul is supposed to do 3 workshops on narrative writing, creative nonfiction, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. While he's here. And it's on 2 month cycles, and there's a lot of work in between because we actually work with these students after the workshop is over. We work with them on their stories and shaping it and stuff like that. So I've been doing that. I just got out of Chennai, where we were there for 16 days. There was a 4 day narrative writing workshop followed by a 6 day photojournalism workshop. We literally, as we speak, planning Kolkata, which is in the first 2 weeks of November, the last of the workshops in the series. So there's been that, and that's actually taken up a lot of my time in a way that I like. I like teaching. I like working with young people, mm-hmm. and it's giving me that opportunity, and that's opening up other opportunities. I've had somebody reach out. In fact, I have a lunch meeting today, which is to discuss another such workshop series. Somebody wants to start it, an international group, and they want to know what we've been doing, what we've learned, and how it would be structured and stuff like that. So there is that. And I've been doing writing for myself. I don't know what it'll turn out to be. I'm basically a reporter by instinct. I'm not a fiction writer. Like some of you guys, you, Amit, all of you all have moved into fiction. I don't think that's my field. Mm-hmm. I prefer writing about people, about the things that I see and hear. And I've been building a collection of that. I don't know what will happen to it. But I've been doing a lot of that. I remember somebody asking about Mahabharata, and you just brought it up. I did that first one on a whim. It was a book that I thought deserved wider notice, and there were things that I could bring to it. So it was not just translating. That led me to another book called Ininyan Urangate, which is basically Let Me Go to Sleep Now. It is the Mahabharata told from Draupadi's point of view. It is a story of a woman who, you know, was constantly being molded into forms and shapes and roles that she didn't want. It's a highly eloquent book. It won the Sahitya Academy Award. And I've been trying to transcreate that, just like I did with M.T. Vasudevan Nair's book. The problem is that this is from the point of view of a woman, and I'm not sure that I've got the woman's voice right. So I've done 2 drafts. I'm now working on the third one. So there's a lot. None of it, much of it not visible. But yeah, I'm happy. I'm occupied. I'm having fun.
So, since you're talking about Mahabharata, let me plug my book in case you haven't read it, Prem.
No, I have, actually.
You have read it, okay. So, all right. So, I guess that brings us to the conclusion of today's episode. It was great having you, Prem. It was like I learned a lot of things, and I hope my audience did too. And I, you know, really hope that you can come back, you know, in a subsequent episode. I think there's a lot to talk about. A lot to talk about as India Australia coming up, so we should definitely talk more about cricket. So I'll now return the mic to Vikram.
Absolutely great fun. Any famous last words, Prem?
No. Thanks you guys for having me on. This is the most fun I've had in some time on a podcast. Usually it's like, what is your view on this and that? And Arnab, compliments for being the antithesis of your namesake.
Thank you.
You know, I did an Arnab show on the 30th of December 2009. I remember the exact date for various reasons. And at the end of it, I told Arnab that was the last time I was appearing on any show that he was hosting. Because, no, seriously, I ended up playing. Pardon?
What was the topic of that show?
Oh, that was Shashi Tharoor. Early on, Arnab realized that what I had to say went contrary to what he was hoping for.
Okay.
So he just ignored me. At that time, there were only three guests in total in Arnab. It was, less crowded kind of space. But he just bounced the mic off the other two and left me alone. And I was sitting there playing Angry Birds. I swear, I'm not making this up. This has been fun. And since the Australia series, at least the test matches are something that I'm going to be following. Yeah, love to be back whenever you guys need me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Prem. And for everybody else, again, my Twitter handle is at Great Bong. This is Attention Please Podcast. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a patron at the Patreon page. And by the way, for those of you who follow Great Bong, I've revamped the page. It looks a little different now. So in case you haven't visited greatbong.net in a while, please go there. Thank you.
And this is Vikram Mohan. And of course, before we sign off, we do need to find out the winner of last week's What Song Contest. This was a sitter as we expected, and we got loads of responses. The answer is, of course, the Zubi Zubi song from Dance Dance. And our winner chosen at random is Anchal G. Anchal, I've sent a mail to you asking you for your address, and you should be getting a copy of one of Arnab's books of my choice very soon. So congrats. We don't have a What Song Contest for this week though. So stay tuned next week. We'll have the contest again and lots of fun yet again. This is Vikram Mohan. I am on as at the Vikram Mohan on Twitter. You can also follow the network at Talking Stuff Net. You might want to subscribe to our other podcast, which is the Talking Tech Podcast, where Vinayak and I discuss technology news and views, but for the non-technical person. So make sure you tune into that as well. It's available wherever this podcast is. And we'll see you next week.